EdTech Crew, episode 175. Episode 175 was recorded on Saturday, 17th of September 2011. It's an interview with Stephen Downes. In this episode, we interview one of the deep thinkers about online and network learning, Stephen Downes from Moncton, Canada. We discuss MOOCs, personal learning, network learning, the old daily, and the workflows, among other things. Enjoy. Welcome, everybody. This is episode 175 of the EdTech Crew. I'm Daryl Branson, the ICT guy, and with me, as always, is my good friend Tony Richards from IT Made Simple. G'day, Tony.
G'day, Daryl. How are you?
Excellent. It's really worth getting up early on a Saturday morning if we get to speak to people such as Stephen Downes.
Yes. Looking forward to it, especially as I've taken the leap and jumped in to the MOOC that's about to get cranking in. I think we're in orientation week this week.
Excellent. Well, we'll have to ask him about that. Just for our listeners, Stephen Downes is the creator of a widely read email digest called The Old Daily, which is about learning and education. He's published countless lectures, presentations, and other resources around open learning, personal learning, network learning, MOOCs, and all things related, and all under Creative Commons licenses. And he's also Moncton's most prominent cyber citizen, researcher, and educator. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
I just touched on some of the many things that and resources that you put out there. But just for our listeners, Stephen, would you like to give us a little bit of an idea of your background and what your current role is and how you go about all things on the internet at the moment?
I have a bit of a checkered background. I'm not sure how much detail I want to get into. My academic background is in philosophy, if you can believe it. That's what I studied formally at the University of Calgary and then later at the University of Alberta in Edmonton. Those are both in Western Canada. As I was learning philosophy, I got exposed to the whole world of distance education by means of a job that I got with Athabasca University as an online tutor. And I worked with Athabasca for 7 years. And that was pretty cool. I learned a lot and made a little money, not a lot of money because it was a tutoring position, but it sure opened my eyes to the world of distance and online teaching. I jumped to a development job at Assiniboine Community College in Brandon, Manitoba. And if you're wondering about that, it's a smack dab in the middle of the country. And just imagine wheat and canola fields as far as the eye can see, perfectly flat, and then a city of about 40,000 right in the middle of that, and that's Brandon.
Wow.
Quite the interesting place to be working. Jumped to the University of Alberta after 4.5 years of that to build Muni Mall, an information resources and learning portal for the municipal section back in Alberta. So that was for town managers, elected officials, and the like. And that's still running. I did that in 1999, and they're still using the same design today, which to me is pretty amazing. And then after that, I got my current position, which is at the National Research Council of Canada here in Moncton, New Brunswick, Canada. I've been here now almost 10 years and have been doing a variety of different things, including a bunch of the things that you mentioned in the intro, OL Daily, which is my daily newsletter. I've done a number of projects with some companies, including a recent project we just wrapped up with Desire to Learn. They're a big content creation, learning material creation and management thing. We had a lot to do with building that and are very pleased with the results because Desire to Learn has certainly expanded in the marketplace. And as you mentioned, the online courses, the MOOCs, this is, I forget how many now, seventh or eighth or whatever that I've done between myself, George Siemens, Dave Cormier, Rita Kopp. We've done a bunch of them over the last 3 years. We've had more than 10,000 people in them. And we currently have the Change MOOC. This is the orientation week. We're up to about 1,600 people in it, give or take. And I just spent all day today integrating the Grasshopper software which is my own application that I wrote to support these MOOCs, integrating that with Big Blue Button so that now with a click of a link from Grasshopper, a click of the link from the course website, in other words, you can pop into the online conference, the synchronous conferencing environment. So I'm very proud of myself for that.
Oh, look, that's super. And we might get you just to expand on a couple of those things. Like I heard you mention the Big Blue Button, which is an open source flash-based, isn't it? Open source flash-based video conferencing solution? Bit like Illuminate?
It's a bit like Illuminate. I think it's more like Adobe Connect than it's like Illuminate. But it's the same kind of thing, right? You go into the environment. There's a bunch of other people in the environment. You can have little video boxes of yourself so other people can see you. You can speak and other people can hear you. A presenter can present slides. A presenter can present a desktop. So the same kind of thing, yeah.
Yeah, excellent. Now, we were going to get to this question later in the show, but now might be a good time to tackle it. You mentioned the MOOC. For those, like we've mentioned it a couple of times on our podcast here, but we're not super up with it as well, apart from Tony enrolling this week. But could you explain to our listeners what a MOOC is?
Okay, well, the term MOOC, M-O-O-C, is an acronym. It stands for Massive Open Online Course. And it's basically what the acronym says. It's a course. It's very often affiliated with a college or university course, and our current one is affiliated with one of Athabasca's distance education courses, except that it's opened up to all comers. And what we do is we don't just make the learning materials open, although we do that, but we make the actual course instruction open. So all of our online sessions, everything we do in the course, in fact, is open and accessible to anyone else in the world. And because, you know, when we first started this, we figured we'll do this, we'll get about 25 people. We did this and we got 2,200 people. So we sort of had to adapt a bit. The structure of the MOOC, in order to accommodate and indeed even support this openness, is a distributed structure. And what that means is the course doesn't take place in just one environment. Participants in the course use their own web resources, their own blogging software, their own Twitter account, their own Facebook account, whatever they want, in order to participate in the course. And then the software that we use in the course, and it could be any software, we just use this one because we have it, aggregates all the materials related to the course from around the web, brings them together, and sends them out in the daily newsletter. So that sort of gives the course a bit of structure that it might not otherwise have. You don't have to use the software that we do, but then it gets a bit trickier. But the concept is still the same, where you have this cluster of people united around some sort of concept or theme or idea. The thread is typically provided with a course tag. Our course tag is the hash change 11 hashtag. You know, other courses use other tags. And the idea is there's this cluster of people around this tag reading, communicating with each other, and through that process, learning. And that's a MOOC.
And how does that scale, like for participants that are doing that course? I know feedback's such an important part of learning. So is it just as important to get feedback off others as well as the course instructors? How does that look?
Yeah, everything we've seen so far suggests that it scales very well. We'll get some test of that. There's a Stanford artificial intelligence MOOC that started up. Now, they're doing a few things differently than we are, and there's some question whether it actually counts as a MOOC, but they're having to scale up to more than 200,000 people, so we'll see, right? But with the interaction, obviously, you can't have personal one-to-one interaction between the instructor and 2,200 or 1,700, let alone 200,000 people. So the interaction of the community among themselves is very important. what we've discovered is we offer the course 1 year. People come in and there's some interaction and some learning. We offer the course the next year. The same people come in again, not all of them, but some of them. And then they take on the role of teachers or mentors themselves. Why? Because they can. We don't stop them. And so over time, the interaction in these courses improves and becomes better. I think personally, I think these courses can be as interactive as, you know, any other course online. It's just you have to recognize that the interaction isn't necessarily going to be all the time between you and the instructor.
Stephen, do you find with the MOOCs that that when educators join up, that you know you'll get a range of skills, but that people start to develop, you know, their thinking and activities together as a group and build on that?
Well, they're not intended to do anything together as a group particularly. We have this idea of online learning and learning in general. Is this, you know, first you create this group and this group awareness and the group identity, and we all have a common vision, share a common goal and all that. MOOCs aren't structured that way. That doesn't mean groups can't form, but there isn't intended to be a single common group. When people come into a MOOC, they learn at different paces. They're looking to learn different things. Sometimes they'll learn the skills, you know, to get more involved in the course. Other times they're just happy reading the newsletter and that's it. There's the full range of participation, and that's what we support. We want it to be that way because we want each individual to have their own individual experience of the MOOC. That makes the interaction better because when they come together, they don't have to, but when they do, they've each had a different experience, have a different perspective, and so they have something to talk about.
Mm. Do you think that changes? I reckon that's a great idea, and I think I probably come into them more with that mindset of, I guess that's probably conditioning and other activities of getting together as a group. Do you think with online, because, you know, things have really, you know, changed recently with more of the social tools online to help connect, that in the future, you know, connecting with all those, you know, different people around to help others ad hoc develop is something that you'll see more, occur more?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think it's happening anyways with or without our courses. I think it's happening in, you know, thought. I love the bird in the background, by the way. I think it's happening in thousands of Facebook groups and Google groups and Twitter hashtag circles, etc. You know, there are large clusters of people, and clusters, I think, is the precise word to use here. Mm-hmm. Clusters of people who exchange, mutually support, and work sort of as something like cohesive whole. I wouldn't go so far as to say they collaborate because they might not be that cohesive. But you can certainly see this activity taking place. All we've done in a MOOC is adapt that structure, which already exists, to a more explicitly educational function.
Yeah, and I think that's a great idea. And you've actually given, there's more food for thought for myself being involved in terms of the way I view it. And anyone should, you know, we've got the links on the show notes, Daryl, so people should jump on and have a look. And like Stephen says, you know, your people's participation can be whatever they want.
Yeah. Right. And Stephen, what are some of the sort of typical tasks that you have people doing inside of the MOOC or outside of the MOOC?
Well, I mean, these vary with every MOOC, right?
Is it mainly around reading, responding, blogging? Is there any sort of must-dos, or it's just all it's up to the participant?
It's always up to the participant, and in the ideal world, the participant comes up with their own activities. And a number of them have already done so. You know, we're still in week one, but they're creating their own activities in other environments away from the course, which is exactly what we want. And there's really no limit. We've tried in this course, that having said all that, to build a bit more of an activity component in it, because otherwise it does feel a bit like, you know, a sit back and listen kind of course, which isn't really the best way to do learning. And we want to get the idea across to people that they actually should be doing stuff and not just listening. And in this course, it's a long course, and it's structured in such a way that each week we bring in a different expert in the field of learning and technology and focus on their work, their contribution to the field over that week. And they are providing us with a written contribution. I use the word written very loosely. It can actually be pretty much anything, but they're academics. So most of them will be written contributions. And then we're asking course participants to create a response to that. And how we go about creating that response is a little bit open at this point. But the idea is we want to put together some sort of open ebook, which may have text and may have other stuff, but open ebook with one chapter for each week, where each chapter contains the expert's contribution and then the course participant's discussion or elaboration or whatever they've done with it as a follow-up. So, and that's for two reasons. First of all, we think it'd be a really good book. And secondly, we think it'll focus some people in the direction of doing activities when they might not have otherwise. But it's not limited to that. They don't have to do this. They don't have to do anything else. The only exception to that is in the case of people who are taking the course for credit at some institution, and that institution will have assignments that they need to do. There are some students taking this for credit, for example, at Athabasca University. They will have assignments. I don't even know what they are, and frankly, I don't care.
Daryl, just to give you an idea, I'm actually in the planning, and it's planned up to week 36 into May next year. And Stephen, you've got presenters pretty much for every week apart from two over the Christmas period, which is amazing.
Yeah, and we stopped there. I wanted to go on, but they wouldn't let me. There's many, many more people we could be talking to who are authoritative. And I really wanted to get some more breadth and some more diversity in there. Not just diversity in the usual sense, but diversity in terms of field and area of interest. We're a little light on corporate. We're a little light on K-12. So we're a little light on public education or advocacy education. So there are other places we could be going with that. So I'm really looking at there being a second part to this course.
Yeah. Stephen, obviously people can do as much or as little as they want, but what would be a bare minimum would you need to do to sort of keep up with the course, or could you, over 36 weeks, keep dipping in and dipping out?
Yeah. It's a funny way of phrasing that. And I know it's a very ordinary way of phrasing that you used, but it's a funny way of phrasing it. Now, think about the way you phrased it. You said, what do they need to do in order to keep up? Right? And the presumption is there's a beginning, then there's a flow, and then there's an end. Right? A lot like reading a book, say. And it's linear, and it moves along in that path. And keeping up means, collecting enough content to get by or something like that. But the thing is, the learning in this course does not come from absorbing the content. There is content. That's not what we're getting education experts. There better be content. It'll be really good content and engaging content, but the learning doesn't come from learning that content. The learning comes from working with that content as it comes, interacting with other people, etc. So basically, the amount of learning you do is proportional to the amount of participation you do in the course. If you participate in the course quite a bit from beginning to end, you do quite a bit of learning. If you participate in the course for like week number four and that's it, you'll do, proportionally that much less learning. You'll do 1/35th of the learning that they would have done. If you take part in the online sessions and do a lot of reading and a lot of writing back and forth, you'll learn more. If you skip the sessions, read the newsletter, and don't really do any interacting, you'll learn less. It's not a case of keeping up or anything like that. It's just you go in, you dip in, you learn a little bit, you leave. There's no sense that here is some stuff that you need to learn this and go away. And if you didn't learn this, you're a failure. It's we know you'll learn. We don't know what you'll learn, and frankly, we don't care what you'll learn. That's not completely true, but you know, in terms of identifying it as a set of competencies or a set of learning outcomes or something like that, that makes no sense, especially for this kind of course. And I would argue in learning in general, but that's a different argument. We can come back to that if you want. So we're quite sure, based on past experience, people who participate in this course will learn something. The learning will be identifiable in some way. It might not be effable. You might not be able to express it in words particularly, but the participant will leave with the sense that they have learned something, and this will become clearer to them over time as that learning sinks in and assimilates with the rest of their learning and experience. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. So the focus, although you have content and they are learning certain things, but I suppose one of the big takeaways from this course would be, sorry, that was just a bird that hit that's stuck in my shed here.
That would explain why it stopped cheeping.
One of the big things would be the network learning, and I know you've described that theory before. Would you like to outline a little bit about your theories on network learning and how that works, about the way the internet changes that sort of thing as far as a learning theory?
Okay, here's the theory in a couple of sentences. Networks learn. And to say that a network learns is to say that a network has taken a certain shape or a certain topography consisting of a set of entities or nodes and a set of connections between those entities, or as they're sometimes called, edges. I hate the term edges, and therefore I'll never use it in this discussion again. There are various reasons for that, but mostly I just think it's a dumb term. So if you imagine a network, so you've got a whole bunch of entities, and imagine that network over time connections form between those entities. That's learning. The formation of those connections is learning. Knowledge is the result of learning. Knowledge on this picture is the set of connections between the entities in this network. You might think, well, that's really stupid. That's not learning at all. Learning is getting a fact and remembering it. But let's look at one of the most common types of networks, the human brain. The human brain is composed of something like 10 billion neurons. The human brain is plastic, which means that it can add or lose neurons, but more importantly, it can form or drop connections between those neurons. When a human learns, what's happening is the connections between neurons grow. Even as you're sitting here listening to me, there are connections forming between neurons in your brain. Now, they're not forming rapidly and right away. Most of the time, what's happening is existing connections are being strengthened and other existing connections are being weakened. But even now, as we speak, the strengthening of these connections may result in the actual formation of new connections. So that's learning. Because learning is the strengthening and formation of these connections, you can't simply equate it to the absorbing of a fact, because if you look at a human brain, there are no facts, there are just neurons and connections. You cut open a brain, there are no facts, there are just neurons and connections. A concept, the idea of Paris, say, in your mind, is not contained in any individual place, rather it is scattered across your brain. It is a series of connections that would very loosely correspond to what the word Paris signifies. So the typical traditional picture of learning as being the retention of propositions or facts or even skills is misrepresentative of what's actually happening. Knowing this, and the part that I've just told you is not the contentious part. It's not the controversial part. It's pretty well established. Knowing this, then, our pedagogy is directed toward the creation of experiences that lead to the formation of connections between these neurons in your brain. And these experiences are the experiences that we set up and structure in the Connectivist course. There's a part B to all of this, and part B is this. Society is also a network. Society, the network in society, is composed of individual people and the connections between them. Societies also learn. This learning takes place in the same way. And what's really helpful is we can actually observe this learning happening. We can see the connections being formed between individuals. We can see what society as a whole has learned and knows by the way society reacts to different things. So the way we structure society, the way we structure the organization of learning, is also in a way to most effectively form these connections in the social network. I'll stop now because I was hearing some gasping there.
No, Stephen, that's really good. A question I've got then, when you talk about learning and if we relate it to the MOOC, how do you then, as a MOOC organizer, understand that the MOOC is actually meeting the needs, you know, the general needs of participants?
If it wasn't, they'd leave.
Okay. So outside of people leaving, are they the only parts that you collect to get an understanding of the development of, you know, what people are after and where you want to head?
Mm. Well, I mean, there's an intentionality in that question that just isn't in a MOOC. I'm not trying to manage the outcomes. I'm just trying to create the environment.
Yep.
I don't know what people want to get out of the MOOC. And if I need to know what people want to get out of the MOOC, and there's 2,200 of them or 200,000 of them, then I've got some serious design challenges. So in my case, it makes a lot more sense to design a structure that supports their ability to articulate and work toward their meeting their own objectives in their own way. And by fostering that, we foster success. Instead of trying to define success and instead of trying to define a mechanism that leads people to success, we let people define their own success and try to enable or empower their activities leading toward that success. And seriously, if it's not working for them, they'll leave, and that's a perfectly good measure.
Yeah. No, I guess what I'm picking up, or you know, even in my own head, Stephen, is the idea that and looking at the MOOC, the idea of you've got a key theme. Which I guess points towards, you know, you've got change, which is part of the current one that's starting. As an educator, if you're not interested in change and what that entails and what it brings, then don't come and jump in, I guess, is the basic statement, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, other people can create MOOCs, and they have.
Yeah.
What the reason why we picked the topic that we have, George, Dave, and myself, is this is the topic that interests us. You know, in this MOOC, we are, you know, I mean, we're sort of like first citizens in that we're a little bit more directive than everybody else. But, you know, it's more like we're doing this inquiry and people are free to join with us if they want. And if they don't want to, that's cool, too. I mean, there are some other MOOCs out there. There's one that I know of that has about 400 people. There's another one, she calls it a small to medium-sized open online course, or SMOOC, has 100 and some people in it. That's okay, too. They're not going to be as interactive and communicative as this one is, probably. Who knows? Dynamics are different, right? People might decide to do something different. But the main thing is it is the interest of the organizers that determines the content. But again, the content isn't the important part here. The content is the thing that gets us up in the morning. And it's sort of like, well, what else would we talk about? But the learning is determined by the people who are participating.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, having this conversation, that a lot of that stuff now in terms of a MOOC starts to drop for me in terms of how I go about interacting with it as well and understanding the fundamentals of what, you know, you guys have done. And I probably should have done more research, Stephen, before asking you those questions.
No, that's fine. I didn't read any of the questions you sent me. So.
Oh, that's good.
Excellent. Before we move on, Stephen, one question I have got. What's the state of play of distance education in Canada? Because I met with you once many years ago at Alice Springs School of the Air, and you were visiting here in Australia. And
I remember that. I was like almost an hour late for that.
Yeah, and we had a kind of conversation. But Canada, you know, going back a couple of years, was, you know, really out there in terms of what it was doing in distance education for K-12 space. Is that still happening?
Well, Canada is very advanced, but, you know, I mean, we've got national fiber networks and all of that. We have a community access program that puts internet into every community. When I was out camping, I used the CAP program to access good quality internet from the little town of Alberton in Prince Edward Island. All the schools, of course, are connected. Most of the citizens are connected. Higher education is connected and has its own higher education research network called Canary. So a lot has happened. Every university in the country has some kind of online learning program or another. Pretty much all of the colleges, certainly all but one of the colleges. The schools, it's a bit mixed. Quebec and Ontario in particular are very advanced, using different constructivist approaches, along with, you know, a good base of support in online learning. Other provinces are catching up. New Brunswick announced about a year and a half ago a big 21st century initiative. 21st century schooling kind of initiative, which is, you know, basically constructivist, hands-on, collaborative, etc. And then we had an election, and now the government's pulling back from that. That happens too. Alberta has Alberta SuperNet and Alberta, I forget what they call it, the Alberta Distance Learning ADLF, whatever, but a province-wide fiber network of distance learning support. There's Athabasca University, of course, which provides college and university by distance online for anyone in the country and, for that matter, around the world. So there's all of that. On the other hand, we've kind of stalled. There used to be large national projects, and these have been to a large degree curtailed. The funding for them has dried up. Some of the initiatives of the past, like British Columbia's Open Learning Agency, have been folded. There's a bit of a push toward privatization, but that hasn't really taken off. There's a bit of a push toward homeschooling, but again, that hasn't really taken off except locally in Alberta. There was more support from organizations like Heritage Canada, which is a federal government department. But again, their funding is back, has been withdrawn. So we're sort of in this period of retrenchment. There isn't new money coming on stream. There is a corporate internet sector, which is alive, but, you know, and not dead, but not massively growing yet. So we're losing ground, you know, compared to what Britain has done over the last, say, 4 or 5 years. Canada has stood still and Britain has moved forward quite well. But, you know, I mean, where we were was so far ahead of everyone else that we're still, I think, pretty much ahead of everyone else. But, yeah, we do stand to lose a lot of that advantage.
Yeah, it's interesting the way that when different governments come into power, that it changes the whole push and the whole agenda, and which is difficult from an educator's point of view because, you know, like between the 4 years or however long they get into power, it can have a great impact on your work and what you actually do. Stephen, if I could just change the topic for a moment. I've been a subscriber to the Old Daily for years, and it's probably cost me a lot in productivity because each morning when I open it up, you know, there's 5 or 10 interesting articles that I want to go off and read. For those, I don't know if we've had many listeners that weren't subscribed, but could you explain what the Old Daily is? And then the question I really want to get to is how do you do it on a daily basis?
Oh, wow. Okay. OL Daily began years ago, like in the 90s, as a way for me to keep track of my bookmarks because I had a computer at home, I had a computer at work, I had a laptop, I had 3 instances of Netscape. Back then it was Netscape, right? And therefore I had 3 sets of bookmarks. Everyone knew back then that you could save your bookmarks as an HTML file, and I tried carrying them back and forth between computers for a bit, and that didn't work. But then I discovered that I could set up a simple little database on my website and store my bookmarks there, and then they'd always be available. Now, having done that, I needed an input screen, so I created one. And then I needed, you know, a way to display them, so I created that. And sort of gradually built this up over time. In 2001, I added a mailing component to it, and then my little daily store of bookmarks that I was storing on my website became a newsletter. And that's why OL Daily takes the form that it does. It's 6 to 8 short items every day, every weekday. I take weekends off mostly. 6 to 8 is a very loose calculation. Yesterday it was 4. The other day it was 2. Some days it's 10. I don't really worry about it. The length is typically 100 to 200 words because they're bookmarks, right? They're not essays. I have a blog for my essays. But what I wanted to do is to capture enough of a description of these items so that, first of all, when I went back to them later, I'd know what the thing said. And then secondly, if I have a thought about the thing off the top of my head, I've captured that as well. So, you know, Joe Blog says such and such, and I think this is so and so. And that's the format. Sometimes they're longer, sometimes they're shorter. Again, I don't obsess over the length. Sometimes I'll add opinion, sometimes I won't. I mean, I don't feel obliged to cast an opinion on every single item. Sometimes I'll just run the item and a quotation out of the item. Sometimes I'll just run the item and a quick synopsis. That's fine too. Sometimes I'll run the title to the item and have an opinion that's completely unrelated to the item on some other topic. I feel free to do that because I do.
Yeah.
So anyhow, and that's all it is. I mean, these things get put into an HTML page. The HTML page is sent out as email, and people can subscribe to it, and they have.
So I just think the effort that you go to put into it, like just to quote and quote and annotate all of those bookmarks, it must take a certain amount of time. And how many RSS feeds would you follow? Because it's the depth and the breadth of the types of articles and where you pull them from is just pretty amazing.
Yeah. Thank you. first of all, it takes me about 2 hours a day. Typically an hour in the morning after I get up. I get up at 7. Between 7 and 8, I'm doing this. And then typically between 4 and 5, I'm doing this. Right now, for today's newsletter, after we're done, I'll be doing it. I'll be spending 2 hours on it because I spent all day with Big Blue Button. That happens too. Over time, I've set up, you know, you have to keep in mind, right? This is stuff I'd be reading anyways. This is stuff that other people in their lives would be reading anyways if they weren't reading what I write. You know, I'm hoping that what I write actually saves people time so that they can pick and choose more efficiently what they read, and that they're given access to stuff they might not find otherwise. But Now, I've always been reading, as I'm sure you guys are, always been reading about these topics. And so the longest amount of time is just, you know, the scanning around and reading articles. The shortest amount of time is the actual composition of the item itself. It takes me maybe 5 minutes to write 100 words. Maybe 5 minutes. Depending, I can do it faster sometimes, or if I'm stuck for a word, it might take me 10 minutes. So you figure, you know, 6 items, 5 minutes, there's half an hour. That's the actual work. And the rest of the time is just the scouting around for them, which I'd be doing anyways. Over time, I've made my input system really, really efficient. It's always open in my desktop. I can copy and paste stuff into it. I'm working on a system now where all of my stuff comes into my RSS feeds in Grasshopper. Instead of copying and pasting stuff, I just hit a button and all the background bibliographical stuff is done. Because in my newsletter, for every item, I have a link, but also an author and a title. And it's very important that each one of these items has some sort of attribution and provenance so that there's some sort of connecting happening there. That distinguished what I was doing from traditional blogs for the longest time. And then I just do my reading. I have my email. Stuff comes in, people send me stuff, I'm on a bunch of mailing lists, I'm just doing my regular reading, something catches my eye, into the newsletter it goes. RSS feeds, I subscribe to, I can tell you exactly how many I subscribe to here if you give me 1 second, but I subscribe to a bunch, and I have my favorites that I read more regularly than others, but I do sort of keep up. If, you know, it's like a MOOC, though, you know, I mean, I feel free to, like, just mark everything as read and start over because it isn't about keeping up, right? It's a stream, it's a river, and I, you know, I go back to it whenever I want. Where's managed subscriptions? No.
While you're doing that, Stephen, how do you reconcile yourself, though, with the fact that you may miss something? Because, you know that idea of keeping, because that's what, I guess that's an internal struggle that I deal with, because sometimes I think, oh, I'm not keeping up and I've got to go back. And I know I do it simply for the fact that I think I may have missed something.
Yeah. I'll tell you, I miss stuff every day. There is a pile of stuff that has happened that I don't know about. And I've learned to live with that. You know, it's just a fact of life, right? You know, I mean, go to a football game. You're going to miss most of what happens on the field because you can only look at one thing at a time, right? But that doesn't mean you stop going to the football game. It just means you realize that you have to focus your attention. And, you know, if you want to be a good football watcher, you don't just watch the ball. You look around. You keep your eyes open. You're looking at the stands. You're listening. You're keeping an eye on the scoreboard, what's happening out of town. You know, it's the same skill. It's exactly the same skill. 946 subscriptions over the last 30 days. I read 5,565 items. Clicked 176 items and starred 42 items. That's in my Google Reader. Starred means I've saved them for possible later use. That's really common. If I'm just sort of, you know, like in the evening, when I'm just sort of watching TV and puttering, I don't really want to do any work. If I see something interesting, I'll star it. And then I always have my supply of starred items if I need to do a newsletter in a hurry, like, say, between 7 and 8 this evening after a certain interview.
Oh, it's just amazing the discipline to do that on a daily basis. And you can subscribe weekly as well.
Yeah, there's a weekly version, and the weekly version is just all the daily ones stacked back to back to back. So sometimes it reads a little weird because I say, well, as I was saying yesterday, like, by yesterday I mean like about 5 links above. But
Now, Stephen, talking about your workflow and how you get the old daily out, you mentioned your GRSS Hopper software, and you're a big advocate of open. Have you? And you've open sourced that, I've noticed?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah, it's open source. There's a website, GRSS. I just call it Grasshopper, but there's no A in it, right? So grsshopper.downs.ca. On that website, currently the version is 0.2. It's not the most up-to-date. There is a 0.3, which is has been released only in a post on my, in my newsletter. But there's going to be a 4 very soon anyways, and I'll put that in the Grasshopper website. Because the 4 will include the big blue button implementation and a bunch of other stuff I've done for these courses.
Great, fantastic.
Steve, I guess, so, Stephen, Darryl?
I was just going to ask, so is that written in PHP? It's just a web application that people could download, and if they're into setting up server software, they could have a play with it?
Yeah, it's written in Perl.
Stephen, just for our listeners out there, Grasshopper, if to give them the quick rundown version, what would it do for them?
Frustrate them.
Excellent.
No, okay. Suppose you, if you have it downloaded and installed and it's running, and 0.2, that probably won't happen. 0.3 will install really easily, but you have trouble finding it. But if you do a search for Grasshopper 0.3, you will find it. But okay, suppose it's downloaded and installed. What you've got, first of all, is a very powerful RSS aggregator. I mean, really powerful. It aggregates RSS feeds and then it analyzes them and decomposes them so that the stuff coming in isn't just stored simply as a list of articles that you then read, but it's a list of articles. It compiles a list of the authors. It extracts the images and the links to MP3, etc. And it builds a graph of all of that. Which I haven't really done anything with yet. I spent the first part of the summer building the graph capability, and I can't wait to play with it. It does all that, throws all of that into a database. Your database is customizable. You can add fields. If you know what you're doing with the program, you can add tables. It's actually very simple to add a new table, but it comes out of the box with a bunch of tables. It builds pages and parts of pages. There's a powerful system that extracts content from the database and inserts it onto those pages, so you can create a lot of custom output. If you remember Cold Fusion from many years back, it has many of those capacities of just taking the stuff out of the database and presenting it, except you don't need to know SQL to make this work. There's a comparatively simple system of keywording. Then it'll take this content and it works with a series of views and templates, so you can output in HTML, in JavaScript, in RSS, in Atom, in whatever, in email. And of course you can have people sign up and subscribe to one of these pages that you create, and you can send it to them as a newsletter. It's got a chat system built in. It now has a system that connects it to installations of Big Blue Button. Didn't yesterday, does today. what else? It's got a viewer, so you can view the harvested stuff.
So, Stephen, this is a software.
Et cetera.
Stephen, this is a software that's running downs.ca?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, so
everything on my website's run off of that.
So if you want to see what it can do, Tony, we just need to point people towards downs.ca, and that runs a whole newsletter and everything. But obviously, Stephen, what you're describing there is also all of the back-end stuff that it does.
Well, yeah, if you look at downs.ca, for example, and I'll just go there now, not that many of you can see this because this is radio, but if you go to downs.ca, you'll see, well, you see the homepage, you see the newsletter. There's another page, presentations. That's built by Grasshopper. Another page, articles. That's built by Grasshopper. Archives for all the newsletters. There's an archiving system, and you click on it. It's got little calendars with links for all the newsletter archives. The search, etc. All of that is built out of Grasshopper.
It looks great. I'll have to download and have a play, Tony, because you know I like to tinker on the server side.
Yeah, I think we'll both be having a play with that. So thanks. Thank you, Steve. We'll make sure we have a link on our show notes for those that are intrepid enough to explore version 3 of Grasshopper.
Yeah, let me insist. Yeah, use version 0.3 and like do the search for it and find it. Don't just go to the Grasshopper website because I haven't put the link on there yet. It is kind of a one-person project, not by intent. It'd be wonderful if there was a team of people developing it, but who codes Perl?
Obviously you do, which is great. I was just going to say, Stephen, you're like obviously all of your materials, I noticed on your website, they're Creative Commons. And I've actually downloaded your book, and I haven't had a good chance to have a look yet, but the book you wrote on free learning.
Right.
And I noticed that you've got a couple of chapters around copyright and Creative Commons and stuff like that. Do you want to talk a little bit about your book on free learning?
Over the years, I've written a lot about open learning, open content, open educational resources, some of the arguments and motivations behind them, mechanisms for setting them up, stuff about licenses. I've had a long series of disagreements with David Wiley on some of these issues. That's prompted a bunch of the articles. And I felt it was necessary to bring these together and present them as a book because, as I say in the introduction, I come from an open educational resources, open source background that is different from the standard picture. The standard picture is Richard Stallman, GPL, and all of that. But around that time, I mean, Stallman wasn't the only person who ever did open software. There were all kinds of people who were sharing and exchanging. There was the entire bulletin board system of exchanges that was supported by things like FidoNet, and even the bulletin board software itself was free and open exchange. All this happens before Stallman. I grew up in the mud world, multi-user dungeons. I learned how to code on something called an LPMUD. I learned MUD coding on an LPMUD. I learned coding elsewhere before that. I also learned how to work inside what was called the Nightmare MUD line by a guy called George Reese, who went by the name of Descartes, who was very famous in his day in that community. And there were two concerns in that world about open source software. The first concern was being able to access and use it. You know, we depended on each other's stuff. I mean, there weren't commercial alternatives for any of this stuff. There were no commercial, well, I suppose maybe there were commercial BBS systems, and I never heard of any. There were no commercial MUD libs. So you needed to be able to access this stuff. Access was of paramount importance. And secondly, there was the concern, justifiable, that people would take something that was created openly and shared, change a couple of sentences, say, oh, I've created this, slap a copyright on it, and take it right out of Exchange. And that was that phenomenon. I call it conversion, right? You take something that's open and convert it into something that's commercial. That was a bigger danger to our community than pretty much anything else. Somebody coming along and converting basically all the work that everybody had done into a commercial product, blocking access to it. And so, if you wanted to play, you'd have to pay. And we were all very concerned that that not happen. And so that's what our licenses said. And there were licenses before Richard Stallman. There were licenses before GPL. The license on the Nightmare MUD Lib is an example. The license that, as it turned out, the license that I attached to my thing called Stephen's Guide to the Logical Fallacies predates GPL. And they all said basically the same thing. You can use this, but you can't use it commercially. You can't. And what we wanted to say is, you know, you can't convert this. You can't change this from being free and open access, whatever it is, to some commercial product that you'll charge people money for. It's not that we hate commerce. It's that we want access to these things to be maintained. We don't want people blocking access to this code. And so my approach to open content, open learning, open educational resources, and open source software is based on that foundation. It's a very different perspective from the far more commercially oriented view of open source software that comes out of places like MIT, Harvard, Stanford, and Berkeley, which is where you'd expect a commercial sort of open source if you were to come out of. And so that flavors pretty much everything that's in my writing on the subject. And so, you know, to make sure, if nothing else, to make sure that that perspective is represented in some way, because you don't find it in any publication that I've seen. It doesn't exist. I felt it necessary to pull all of these things together and put it in that ebook and post that ebook. And I'll actually get a proper ISBN number for it and do proper publishing on it later on. But the main thing was to get the book out.
Stephen, just with putting that book together, and I noticed there towards the end, there's lots of contribution by other authors. Is this the idea around the MOOC that you'll publish a book with contributions from everyone else as well in a similar sort of fashion?
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
The book, well, yes and no. I mean, at the end, the last part of the book is basically a transcript from an online conference that took place. And individual contributions were made. There isn't any sort of collaborative contributions. In the case of the change course, there might be some kind of collaborative contributions, or there might be individual contributions. I don't know. I mean, so the big difference is I know how the free learning book is structured, but I don't yet know how the course book will be structured. And that's going to be subject to, you know, to lots of negotiations and talking and that, because there's three of us running the course and 1,600 or whatever people in the course. So.
Wow. We might just really interested about you and Twitter, Stephen, and I noticed that you only follow one person. I'm just intrigued.
Yeah.
How do you use Twitter, and why do you only follow one person?
Yeah. Well, like, it's not like I'm not getting any input from other people. Now, let's make that clear right off the bat. As we've just established, I read almost 1,000 blogs on Google Reader. As well, I get
so you don't need email. Any more noise.
I get like several hundred email every day. I'm on Facebook, and so I get a pile of Facebook messages. I'm on Google Plus, and I get a pile of Google Plus messages, although actually that's slowed to basically a trickle, which is actually a bit of a relief. So, and individual tweets, the per tweet value is very low, almost zero. You've got to read through a lot of stuff on Twitter to find the you know, good resources. Yes, there's a lot of conversation that happens on Twitter, and I like conversations. But, you know, if I tweet a conversation, it goes to, I don't know how many Twitter followers I have, but I'm just looking it up.
2,581. Oh, no, sorry, followers are 4,378.
Yeah, so if I'm having, like, you know, a back and forth conversation with, oh, I don't know, Ashley Proud, who's just sent me a tweet, on the other end of that, there are 4,000 people listening to my side of it, and on Ashley's side of it, there are 882 probably different people listening to his side of the conversation. It's just not a good use of anyone's time. you know, it might be good to have an exchange, one back, one forth. And for things like that, I search for the at downs you mentioned. So, you know, if you at downs me, I'll see it. But, you know, I'm not going to search through or even, you know, view 500 tweets to see the one at downs. And I'm not going to have a long, involved conversation with Ashley Proud or anyone else that's going to, like, flood 4,000 people with tweets. It just doesn't make sense to do that. If I want to have a conversation with this person that badly, there are instant messaging channels to use. And if I want to do it in an open and public way, then there are open and public forums I can use where if people really want to see that conversation, they can go to it, but they don't have one half of it sent to them every 30 seconds. So that's, you know, and it's funny because, you know, a lot of people look at me, they look at, you know, I'm following one person. The one person, by the way, for in case you don't know, is Twitter. I follow Twitter.
Yes, so check that out.
And I find Twitter too chatty, frankly. Especially once the retweets started coming on and Twitter started retweeting, and I sent them a snarky remark because it was too much. You know, and they look at my me following one person. They think I'm stuck up and snobbish, and it's like these are people who don't interact with people except within Twitter. And if the only place you interact within Twitter is, or sorry, if the only place you interact with other people is within Twitter, then yeah, it's going to seem that way. But nobody who knows me at all would say that I'm not interacting with other people on the web. I mean, really.
Yeah, fair enough. That's
no, it's Stephen, that's an interesting one. I think you've given us a really good topic for another EdTech crew, because I'm sure there'll be some listeners out there shaking and quaking with the statements you've just made there. But that's what it's all about, isn't it?
Well, personally, it's funny because people say to me sometimes, oh, such and such is going to be very controversial. Nothing I say I think is controversial to me. I think it's pretty obvious and self-evident, right? I've got 4,378 followers. I can't just be firing tweets willy-nilly because I'll just be spamming them. So I have to show some consideration. That's how Twitter is set up. I didn't build Twitter. I didn't design it that way. But given that it is designed that way, well, then, you know, that puts certain constraints on its use.
So how would you have designed it, Stephen? And that's really putting you on the spot.
More like Google Plus. I wouldn't have designed Google Plus the way I did, but, I mean, in that direction. Yeah. The 140 character limit is ridiculous. Sorry, but it is. I get the point. But I think Twitter could have abandoned the 140 limit at a certain point and still maintained the same basic function. So there is that.
We actually like Google Plus as well because of the control you can have over groups and how you share it and things like that. So yeah, we think that's a big plus. And like you said, the 140 character limits is lifted, so you can actually write a little bit more.
I mean, Google Plus falls down because it doesn't support hashtags. The search function on Plus is awful, actually. And I'm really concerned that Google Plus is trying to set up an input stream from commercial publications to whom they'll sell access, of course. And to the exclusion of all other input. So you have to go through Google Plus, Google, to have some way of getting stuff into Google Plus. And so there's no hashtags, there's no RSS reader or anything like that into Google Plus. There's no RSS out of Google Plus. So, you know, I mean, this is some of the big strength of Twitter is its openness. It's such a huge strength. And it could have added these other things on without losing its openness. And it would be probably even better, more powerful than it is today. If they had just taken Twitter, opened it, and then, you know, there's a few other restrictions, the 140 restriction and maybe a little formatting, it'd be a very, very interesting service. But know, even then, well, there's the whole groups thing too. I don't. It's funny you talk about the first thing you mentioning about Google Plus was the circles, how you can organize it. So, like, I have one big circle. So, life's too short to be categorizing my friends into circles.
Oh, Stephen, you've opened so many interesting areas that we could go into, but we won't do that because we not know your time's precious, especially tonight when you want to sit down and relax after your big week. I'm not sure how to ask this last question or these last group of questions because I think you're doing it already, but you know, what's your interest at the moment? Do you have something that's bubbling up inside that's really driving your interest outside of the work and the things that you're doing?
Oh, always. It's a hard question to answer because there's my hobby interests and there's my philosophy interests.
While you're thinking about that, one of your hobby interests, I believe, you're a darts player who plays for money.
Yes. Oh yeah, but no, that's not what I meant, though. Well, I mean there is that, but I mean my other hobby interest is Wii hockey. And I'm just hoping that the new season CD comes out soon because it should be better than it is. But it's so much fun.
Can you explain that for us?
Oh, well, you've heard of hockey, right?
I know, here, we're talking about ice hockey?
Ice hockey. It's a lot like field hockey, except it's on ice and there's more fighting. Yeah, it could be Wii soccer. I mean, it doesn't matter. Or Wii football, I guess, as you guys said. I don't know. You don't call it football. Oh, no. Well, whatever. Never mind. You know what I mean. And Wii, of course, is the Nintendo Wii and has the nunchuck. And they came out with the Wii hockey version, and you got a little plastic stick, a hockey stick, and then you sort of embed your nunchuck into the hockey stick and your controller and your nunchuck. So basically, you play the game by moving the hockey stick around, and then there's a little controller that you use your thumb on to control things like shooting and passing, the like. There's a lot of similarities between that and playing real hockey. A lot of differences, obviously. For one thing, you're not skating, so it's a lot warmer. But, you know, it's a lot of fun. It's very fast. It's very intense. I just wish the game were a bit better, but, boy, it's fun. So there's that. Another hobby recently has been radio, which should speak to your heart. I've been ever since the DS-106 course came on. That was in the spring, winter and spring of this year, January, February. Grant Potter was a DS-106 participant, and he set up DS-106 radio, which is basically an Icecast radio station. Icecast is a lot like Shoutcast, and it's streaming audio over the web, and you can also play streaming audio with, you know, Real Player or QuickTime or whatever. And so it's just this streaming audio server. And once I saw what he had done, I decided I really liked that. And then I got into a dispute with the people on DS-106 over scheduling and timing and communicating on Twitter because that was their medium of choice, and they'd have these long conversations on Twitter. And, of course, I'm following one person. Anyhow, so long story short, I set up my own radio station, which I call Ed Radio, and I've been having a lot of fun with that. And I've been making these long, involved broadcasts to an audience of zero people. And it makes no sense whatsoever. It's completely ridiculous to be doing a radio show, you know, with crossfades and you know, the DJ in between. Not of music, though, like of YouTube videos. This show, I did an episode with one of the episodes of EdTech Crew and other things, and I'm broadcasting it to nobody.
Yeah, I noticed you were brutally honest about your subscribers and listeners.
Yeah, well, because the point, I've always said to people, you know, I've said to people about my newsletter, I'd be doing this if nobody was reading it. And, of course, who believes that, Right. And same with the course. Or I'd be doing these even if nobody was taking the course. It's still worth doing. And who believes that? Well, same with the radio station. I'd be doing it even if nobody was listening, because the experience of doing it, the possibility that someone out there might listen, creates something that isn't there otherwise. And it turns out it's true. I am still doing it. I was broadcasting yesterday. You saw it, where if you read my newsletter, you saw my show notes. That was a real show. I didn't just gather some links together. I actually played all of those on Ed Radio to my audience of zero people, and I did some chatter in between, introduced each item, complained about the audio quality of one of them, and so on. I have a recording of it. I take some of the recordings and for Auto DJ, which plays the radio station when I'm like sleeping, you know, it'll play some of these shows. But again, Auto DJ's typically also playing to an audience of zero people. But it's just the experience of doing it. And, you know, you asked earlier, how do you find the time to do OL Daily every day? Doing OL Daily every day has been the best professional development experience I could possibly have come up with. You know, the analogy, and it's a good analogy and it's a deliberate analogy, is like exercise. And you're Australian. You guys probably exercise on a regular basis. I understand every Australian does. I'm just kidding, of course. But there are like gazillions of people out there who do at least some exercise on a regular basis, right? You know, they go for a walk or they go for a run, ride a bike, whatever. They do it because, you know, if you do it every day, you get in shape. You know, it's like people who do, I'm trying to think of it, like shadow boxing, right? They'd be boxing even if nobody else is boxing against them, right? Why? Because it's good exercise to do it. Same thing with the newsletter, right? It's such good exercise. I immerse myself in this process for a couple of hours every day. And after doing that for 10 years, I'm one of the leading figures in the field. Why? Because not because I've remembered everything I've done over the last 10 years. That would be ridiculous, right? But by exposing myself to this stuff, by going through this activity every day for a couple hours over this amount of time, I have a very strong intuitive awareness of what's happening in the field. Now, by intuitive, I'm not saying ESP or anything ridiculous like that. What I'm saying is that I've developed a base of knowledge such that I don't need to do calculations or figuring things out to know this or that about the field. I just know it. It's what Dreyfus and Dreyfus would call expert knowledge. It's this expert knowledge that is ineffable. It's the knowledge that's better than rules or principles because it's adaptive to context and things like that. Doing Ed Radio is the same thing, and I'm discovering by messing around with Ed Radio that I'm acquiring a whole different set of capacities, and it's manifesting itself first as a much greater sensitivity to the domain than I had previously. Same with photography. I've done a lot of photography. I've got like, I don't know, 20,000, 30,000, whatever photos up on Flickr. Love doing photography. You know, and again, you do photography, you do a little, I was involved for a number of years in this, you know, take one photo a day and post it on Flickr. Right, that's better than take one photo a day, because you post it on Flickr, someone might see it. So yeah, you know, it just kind of forces you to take a better photograph. Okay, but taking a better photograph every day means now that you start seeing the world differently. Doing Ed Radio means I start hearing the world differently. You guys do this podcast, I'll bet you have you're much more attuned to things like audio quality or, you know, clarity of expression, pronunciation, enunciation, than you would have been otherwise, and probably much more so than all of the people around you. It's just this practice. It's nothing special. It's nothing that only Stephen can do, and therefore he's special and an expert and a guru and all. Anyone can do it. And, you know, it's just you do it on a regular basis for a period of time and you acquire that capacity. And that capacity isn't the memorization of a bunch of stuff. It's a becoming of something. And so I do Ed Radio because I want to be better at audio. Why do I want to be better at audio? No reason. You know, there's not some sort of, you know, big holy grail there. It's just it interests me. You know, and all of that together interests me. You know, the philosophical interest to me is wrapped up around all of this, this way of thinking, this way of learning, of interacting with the world.
So, Stephen, it sounds like your leisure is your work, and your work is your leisure, and that those sort of things are intertwined. Just as a finish up question, who actually determines your role as a researcher, and how much autonomy do you get in the direction of what you do throughout a working week?
Well, that's a matter of considerable dispute. When I was hired. I was hired under the condition that, you know, I was a researcher, an academic, very much like a university professor, except without the students. There would be certain measures on which I would be evaluated, those measures being, for example, publications in the field, presentations, keynotes in the field, participation in projects with partners, patents, etc. There's a whole range of stuff. But beyond that, you know, I would choose my own area of inquiry, you know, within broad parameters. You know, I can't just sort of drop e-learning and go into fine cuisine. Although, you know, NRC probably would have found a way to accommodate that when I started 10 years ago. More recently, they've discovered research management and are more and more attempting to direct the research into specific directions, which works, I think, less well because, you know, you can try and try and try, but I'm never going to be comfortable working in health, e-health, health analysis, etc., which is one of the areas they want to push us. I'm just not interested in it. And more to the point, I'm not good at it. And I don't like health stuff. I don't watch ER. Hospitals are places I avoid, you know. So, and that's part of the difficulty with this managed research approach. So right now we're sort of in a stalemate.
Okay.
let's just say it's fluid. But for now, and until things change dramatically, I'm continuing to work under the conditions under which I was hired. And those conditions are basically I'm an academic, I'm a researcher, and I determine my own area of inquiry within broad parameters.
Yeah. Well, listen, Stephen, from our point of view, we hope that you can continue in your role because just the list of resources that you provide for other people, the debate, the conversation that you generate – is fantastic, and we're just wrapped to have you on the EdTech crew today, and I'd just like to encourage people to go across to downs.ca and join up to the Old Daily, have a look at some of your resources. I know you've got your more longer blog at halfanhour.blogspot.com, yeah. Sorry, and also to go and check you out on Twitter as well.
Well, thanks, and I also have a blog called Let's Make Some Art, Damn It. blogspot.com.
We missed that one.
Thank you, Stephen. That's fantastic. Lots of good ideas, and you've certainly changed some of the way I was thinking about the MOOC, so I'm going to try and put that into practice.
Well, great. Well, thanks. I enjoyed this, and I apologize to your listeners for making this go over an hour.
That's fine. They're used to us, and getting times wrong and stuff like that. So, we'd just like to thank you for the conversation today, and we'll catch up with everybody again next week. Tony, it's been a pleasure again.
It has been excellent. Lots of food for thought. And thank you.
And it always amazes me how Ashley Proud manages to sneak into the show.
Yeah, he's our podcast bomber, number one.
That's funny.
We'll see you
later. Yeah.